I'm John Tupper with Harvard Media News. Earlier today, I sat down with Nihid Nanshi, leader of Alberta's NDP and official opposition.
Welcome to Fort McMurray, Mr. Nanshi.
It's so great to be back up here, and thanks so much for taking the time.
So on that note, what brings you up here today?
Well, I wanted to spend a little bit of time here because I haven't been here in a while. And we, over the course of the summer, have really been traveling from corner to corner in Alberta on a program we're calling Better Together. We've knocked on over 100,000 doors. We've been to music festivals and dog parks. And we've had a series of town halls. And it occurred to me that we hadn't included Northwestern Alberta in, or excuse me, let's try that again. We hadn't included Northeastern Alberta in all of this. And the last time I was in Fort McMurray was probably 6 or 7 months ago. So I thought it would be a good opportunity to come up, chat with people, kind of get the pulse of what is going on here, how the economy is doing, how people are feeling about the issues of the day, everything from the teacher strike to separatism.
Sure. So, I mean, let's jump right into the teacher strike. Fort McMurray and the Wood Buffalo area has the highest number of children per capita in the country.
Yep.
We're one of the youngest communities in the country. So this teacher strike is particularly disruptive to a lot of families. And there doesn't seem to be an end in sight. What are your thoughts on what's going on?
Well, one of the things that I've been doing while I'm here that we've been doing across the whole province is speaking with parents and speaking with teachers and helping understand what people are really going through. You know, Minister Nate Horner the other day said the teachers need to live in reality. Well, they live in reality. You know, those of us who sit in the legislature dome maybe live a little less in reality. And what is going on in public education is frankly very shocking. We've gone from having one of the very best public education systems in the world. You know, in 2018, Alberta students ranked in the top 5 in the world in math, in science, and in reading. And now we spend the least amount on public education in Canada. That's all since the UCP took over in 2019. Classroom sizes are shocking. The complexity of classes is shocking. The UCP has stopped tracking class size because they don't want people to know. And the really bad thing about this is I always say, you know, when I graduated high school way too many years ago, I graduated from one of the best public education systems in the world. But it's not, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago that it was such a great system. It was 5 years ago. It was 7 years ago. So even the kids who are being badly hurt by the system today, many of whom have gone through the pandemic closures as well, they're not getting the education their older siblings got. And this has happened fast. And it needs to be solved fast, because the learning loss that these students are getting is something that will sit with them their entire lives. And I can't believe that the government has, either through malice or incompetence, allowed this to happen. And I really do think that the teachers are doing a great thing by standing up and bringing this to people's attention. And I will tell you, I have talked to thousands of parents across the province, and they are angry. Their lives have been disrupted. Things are difficult, and I have yet to talk to a parent who doesn't say, and I stand with the teachers on this.
You know, and you bring up a good point, you know, with Alberta having the lowest per capita spending on education. We have a government that fully understands, for example, the value in investing in the Heritage Savings Fund, understanding that when our resources come, you know, to an end, that will pay a return on investment. But they don't seem to quite have the same equation when it comes to education. And if you think of if one of our children today were to invent something like a Google, you know, that company has grown to such a size that it could replace all of the industry in all of Canada.
Yeah, you know, in my previous life as mayor of Calgary, I'm joined here, by the way, in Fort McMurray by my shadow minister of finance, Court Ellingson. Mm-hmm. And the reason I highlight that is because Court used to work with me in Calgary, and he was in charge of Calgary's economic development strategy. And so even then, we were saying, how do we both maximize our investment in energy of all sorts and gain value from that? But how do we also be thinking forward about what are the next industries, and how do we leverage the brilliant minds we have in environment and engineering and health and safety that have come through the engineering the energy sector here, and think about how we can use those folks in different ways. And what's been very disappointing to me is that this particular government doesn't seem to have any economic development strategy. You know, maybe a nuclear small modular reactor here, maybe a data center that'll create 50 jobs there. But at the same time, they scared off investment. Their moratorium on renewables scared off at least $40 billion of investment in Alberta, which will never come back. Their conversations around a pipeline, something that, you know, I have to remind people it was the Alberta New Democrats that got a pipeline built to Tidewater. It's a pipe dream, right? They don't have a proponent. They haven't worked with communities. They just kind of hope that maybe we can do this. But hope's not a strategy, not in these difficult times. So what we really need is a thoughtful economic development strategy. But a critical part of that is we have to attract investment here and we have to attract people here. And you do that by having great public services, great healthcare, great public education, so that people feel like they can make a life here and they want to invest their lives here and invest their money here to create jobs. And the biggest challenge we have right now, Alberta now has the second highest unemployment rate in Canada. Youth unemployment, especially for young men, has almost never been higher. And this is in the absence of a massive global recession, you know, when the world economy is sort of plodding along, unlike, you know, 15 to 19 when we were in a global recession. The unemployment rate today is almost as high as it was then. And this really is because we're lacking that real investment in building the economy. And this, all this talk of separatism, you know, may feel good for some people in the moment, but it is absolutely freezing investment. You know, even the CEO of ATCO, one of Alberta's biggest companies, who's a staunch conservative, by the way, she even basically said she's not going to invest any money in Alberta until the separatism talk is gone. So we've got to be really thoughtful about what creates jobs now and creates jobs in the future.
For sure. And let's, you know, talk a little bit more about energy and pipelines. You know, China has been fairly open about their desire to have more of Alberta's oil. We provide that political stability that a country that tends to think in a 100-year plan want. They're already retrofitting some of their refineries to accept more of our crude. There are a few pipelines that have been talked about that are on the table, one of which is a pipeline that would go through First Nations land from Fort McMurray directly to Churchill. And the First Nations are already forming, a collective. Would you be in favor of supporting that?
Yeah, so we need more export capacity. That's very true. And certainly I had a front row seat to the pipeline wars in 2015. And as mayor of Calgary, I think I played a good supporting role in getting Trans Mountain built. We were unable to get Energy East done. We were unable to get Northern Gateway done. We were unable to get Keystone XL done. We did get Trans Mountain expansion done. And so I have a sense of what it takes to get these things built. And basically what you don't do is announce $15 million of taxpayer money for a committee before you even talk to any of the people who are impacted. You're going to set up a fight from day one, and that's what Premier Smith did. She set up a fight with Premier Eby. She set up a fight with the Coastal First Nations. In fact, one of the Coastal First Nations chiefs said, oh yeah, the Premier's Indigenous Affairs Minister, Rajan Sani, called me the day before the announcement to tell me they were making an announcement, instead of calling her and saying, what would it take for you to be on board with this? How can we come up with a win-win here? So let's not repeat that mistake. And we need to be open to all options. You know, the Prime Minister opened up conversations with President Trump again on Keystone XL. It's not the ideal solution. It still goes to the United States. We have to diversify our markets. And I, too, have spent a ton of time in China and Korea looking at places that could accept Alberta Energy and who are hungry for it. So Keystone XL helps, but is not probably the ideal solution. Can we improve capacity on the Trans Mountain expansion? Yes, Trans Mountain has already said that for a relatively small amount, we could increase significantly the capacity on that pipeline. That's a no-brainer. Let's figure out how to do that. Do we need another pipeline to the West Coast? Yes, but not the way we're doing it now, because that's why Gateway failed, right? You can blame Justin Trudeau and the Liberals, and they certainly didn't fight for Northern Gateway, but ultimately it was struck down in the courts because of lack of Indigenous consent. And we're just going down the same path again. So let's figure out a way to involve Indigenous people, involve landowners in a win-win situation and move forward. I still love Energy East. Maybe the business case for Energy East is not what it was before, but I love it as a nation-building project to show we can do big, great things in this country. And the conversations that we're having with Premier Canoe about Churchill, about northern Manitoba, are fascinating. Again, there are some issues with how north that is, whether it's the right shipping route for a lot of our products, but I think those are solvable problems. And, you know, working with a premier who's excited about it, who has such great respect in the Indigenous communities, is a good way to start that conversation as well.
Yeah, and certainly I've heard a number of indigenous leaders talk about economic reconciliation and bringing the pipeline across, indigenous treaty land for a percentage of the royalties. In their mind, they're saying that makes sense financially, so let's do it.
And we've seen good examples of that. I'm really proud of the relationships that I have built with indigenous communities in my political career. You know, I have an eagle feather war bonnet that means a lot to me because the elders told me this means you're a warrior for our people, and I take that very seriously. But a really good example of this is we were able to broker a deal with the City of Calgary, the Province of Alberta, and the Tsuut'ina Nation to finally complete the Calgary Ring Road after 70 years of discussing it. And that has led to massive economic benefit for the Tsuut'ina Nation, as well as benefits to the City of Calgary. And that's the kind of win-win situation that is possible that we can get to if we approach these things with mutual respect and don't start by setting it up in us versus them fight.
So then the next question, and probably the last question I'll ask on energy is, ultimately we have an emissions cap that was passed by the federal government under Trudeau, with Stephen Guilbeault being the kind of driving force behind that. With that emissions cap and a few other laws, the oil sands are talking about having to shutter in about 2 million barrels per day unless those are lifted. At the same time, they're also at the table proposing some innovative steps in terms of carbon capture and sequestration. Mm-hmm. Fort McMurray as a people, we took a geological curiosity and turned it into a global commodity in one generation. Are you in favor of carbon capture and storage and exploring innovation?
Absolutely. So we used to have something called COSIA, the Canadian Oil Sands Innovation Alliance, which has morphed into Pathways. And they did some of the leading work in the world on figuring out how to help reduce the carbon footprint of the oil sands. And where they've landed is this massive carbon capture, utilization, and storage system that we call Pathways. And it is the right thing to do. What is the shame about this whole thing is, thinking back to 15, 16, 17, we really were working with industry to create this sort of grand bargain. Figure out ways to decarbonize the emissions intensity. We'll figure out ways to continue to build the production. And it's sort of sad that I feel like it's one step forward, two steps back in some ways. And now we're getting people retreating to their positions instead of saying, all right, where's the compromise here? Where's the best use of money that will create the largest investment value and the largest number of jobs for everyone? Because there are jobs in this, right? There are jobs in thinking about what the future of energy is. And I'm worried a little bit that if we all retrench, then that's going to be a problem. So, the very first place in Canada to have an industrial carbon price was Alberta. And that program, which is called TIER, has been tremendously successful. But I think a lot of the, virtue signaling of the previous federal government even poisoned the well for things that have worked, that have been successful. And we've got to figure out how to get back to that. And I also believe, as I always have in my previous roles, that if you're the regulator, if you're the government, the second best answer is no. The best answer is yes. The second best answer is no. The worst answer is, I need more information, or you have to spend more money, or I need more time to make a decision. And so some of the federal government's work under the previous government, for example, with Bill C-69, just was creating massive red tape, but not actually getting to the point where people agree we need solid, smart environmental assessment of every project. We need to know what its impacts are, and we need to be able to make decisions to go forward. So I am actually quite optimistic that the other provinces and the federal government talking about a one-window system, faster regulatory processes can help a lot. But I think we have to look at the whole thing in a big picture and figure out how we get things built that create sustainable jobs and we minimize their impact on the environment. I think it can be done.
Yeah, certainly. I think, human history shows time and time again that our capacity to innovate our way through problems is virtually unlimited if we have the willpower.
Where do we know that better than in Fort McMurray?
Yeah.
Right? Remember, the bitumen used to be used to patch up canoes, mm-hmm. right? And it took brilliant minds and innovation to go, wait a minute, we can turn this into a fuel that the world needs and wants, And over the years, we've reduced the emissions intensity, we reduced the impact on the environment. A SAGD plant looks nothing like an old oil sands mine. And that's where the innovation is happening. We got the smartest people in the world here, not just on energy, but on environment. So let's get those minds to use and to work to figure out how we can solve things. You know, we have to stop in Alberta thinking that we're victims of the world changing. Instead of being bystanders to the changing energy markets in the world, let's lead them. Let's show the world how a fossil fuel intensive region can also lead the world in environmental mitigation. We can do that because we got the brains here. We just need a little bit of money, a government that plays along, and the ambition to set really audacious goals. I think we can do it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll throw in one more myself. We have the Indigenous people here that are partners in the oil sands that are really being able to set the standard for what reclamation looks like to them. They have a history going back 2,000 years. They can tell us what we, you know, should do in terms of reclamation if we only ask and listen. Now I'm going to go into an issue that I'm going to be honest with you, Mr. Nanshi, I don't know a lot about, but corrupt care has been in the news quite a while. So why don't you give us the Cole's notes on that and what's going on?
Sure. This is a simple thing. So, well, it's not simple at all. I'm just pretending it's simple, but I'll give you the Cole's notes. The former CEO of Alberta Health Services allegedly uncovered a bunch of shady stuff going on in the contracting out of private health clinics, hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars. She started pulling on a thread that was with that Turkish Tylenol, $100 million on Turkish Tylenol. And she realized that there was a network of conservative insiders who allegedly were getting these contracts despite not being qualified for them. They were padded contracts. We're talking about massive amounts of money. And an external investigator suggested that this all be turned over to the RCMP. And when the then CEO of AHS brought that to the minister, she was fired. And when the board of AHS complained, they were fired. There's still no board of AHS. And the government has refused to call a public inquiry. There is an active RCMP investigation. There's an active investigation with the Auditor General, which the government has tried to shut down, or not shut down, but they've tried to keep information from going. They actually said that no Alberta Health employee can speak to the Auditor General without their boss and their boss's lawyer being in the room. That is no way to get to the bottom of this. And then they hired a retired judge from Manitoba to do an investigation, but not a public inquiry. Now, there's a difference. In a public inquiry, the judge can compel testimony. He can make people swear an oath to tell the truth. He can get around non-disclosure agreements that have been signed. Judge Wyan had none of that. He was supposed to report in May. He keeps getting extensions. His report was due yesterday. We still haven't seen it. The government says they need to review it before they release it to the public, and they refuse to have a proper public inquiry. And it just smells of cover-up. And in a point where the government is forever telling us they don't have a dollar to give to teachers or to help public education, if we are really looking at hundreds of millions or billions of dollars that have been misspent, this is probably the most important scandal in Alberta government history.
That's very interesting. So when the legislature reconvenes after the throne speech, what is the Alberta NDP going to do to try to push this matter into the public?
I'm pretty excited about the legislature coming back. It'll be my first time in the legislature because I had to wait almost a year for the government to call by-elections to get me in the legislature. They were trying not to get me in the legislature as much as possible. So a week from now, we'll be at the speech from the throne. And then we've got a big fall legislative agenda. So as I mentioned earlier, we've been traveling in every corner of the province. We've actually, you know, you've heard a lot about the premier's town halls. We had a series of them too. We actually got as many people as the premier did. But those are people who love Alberta, love Canada, and we're talking about how they can work to build a better Alberta. We called it Better Together. And during that summer, we learned a lot about what interests people. We let people vote on what they wanted to talk about, and there was always the same. Healthcare, education, affordability, the cost of living, creating sustainable jobs, as well as really, really angry about all this separation distraction. Surprisingly, not one person said, we need a new license plate, and we should spend tons of money on that. So we've developed an agenda for this fall that we're calling Protecting Your Paycheck. We'll be talking about minimum wages. We'll be talking about helping people who work in the service industry keep more of their tips. And we'll be talking about a number of things around building economic investment in Alberta and investing in these issues. But we're also not going to forget about corrupt care. In the spring session, we asked over 300 questions to the government on corrupt care, and the answer was always the same. Wait for the Wyatt report. Never mind that Justice Wyatt wasn't given the powers he needed to do a proper investigation. Let's see what the report has to say, but we can't let this one go. This comes to the heart of what we need in this province, which is ethical and competent government.
Yeah, and let's talk about the makeup of the legislature a little bit here. So the UCP has 46 seats, which is a margin of just 2 seats into the majority territory. You are the largest opposition in Alberta history that you're leading. And already 2 UCP ministers have decided that they would prefer to sit as independents. There's a non-zero chance that we might end up in an election situation earlier than later.
Yeah, absolutely. So the premier has just celebrated her 3rd year as premier. Usually when I say that to people, they go, what? And we're not supposed to have an election now until October 27. It's very clear that the premier is going to call an early election at a time that she thinks is her best possibility. But she might not have the choice because, as you say, this is the smallest majority government in Alberta's history. They are 3 seats away from losing their majority. So if, in fact, more of them decide they can't handle the corruption like Peter Guthrie did, or they're upset that the government is ignoring the needs of Northern Alberta, as Scott Sinclair did, if just 3 more go, then she will no longer have the confidence of the House and will be in a very interesting electoral environment for the first time in Alberta's history. But you know what? Alberta's New Democrats are ready. We, in 2024, became the largest provincial political party in Canada. We have thousands and thousands of members in every corner of this province, including in the 2 Fort McMurray ridings that people would say, oh, you're not competitive there. But we're hearing more and more about people who are frustrated with this government, who are looking for a smart alternative on public services and on the economy. So we're ready for anything. And who knows, we might be back up knocking on doors with orange signs sooner than we think.
You know, and certainly some of the high foreheads that that follow politics a little bit more closely have noted that just the fact that you yourself are somewhat of an NDP outsider elected as leader, that the desire is to build that big tent party. You yourself have even talked about changing the name of the Alberta NDP. Is that still on the plate?
I don't think we should change the name, because one of the things that I have been shocked to understand, shocked, I tell you, most people don't follow politics every day very closely. What? Really? And so, you know, we saw when the BC Liberals changed their name to BC United, they were wiped out. But also, I think that we're very proud of the roots of this party. And I think that really is the fundamental difference between us and the other guys. When you strip the other guys down to, why do you do this? Why are you in politics? The answer too often is for power. And that's not what we're about. For us, winning the election is the starting point, not the ending point. And for us, our values are very deeply connected to the dignity of people on this land, to say, look, if you're lucky enough to be an Albertan, then you deserve to live an amazing life. You deserve to thrive here, to have great public services here. If you grew up poor like me in Northeast Calgary, you deserve a great public education. You deserve to live in a community where people want you to succeed. And before I got into partisan politics, because I was never in partisan politics, I was much too good for that. I held myself above it. Wore purple every day, still do. Wearing purple now, folks on the radio, because it was red and blue. And what I realized is that under Rachel Notley, the Alberta New Democrats had already become that party that represents the central values of Albertans, that the average Albertan can see themselves reflected in who we are. And to me, that's what got me into this game in the first place. And I hope that we can reflect that for people because, you know, here in Alberta, a lot of people, when they vote conservative, think of Peter Lougheed, or maybe they think of Ralph Klein. I knew both of those men very well. And I can tell you, neither Peter Lougheed nor Ralph Klein would recognize themselves in the UCP today. And a lot of folks are saying, they're not my party. And my job is to really convince people that if you want to have a better life, if you're upset about the way your life has gotten worse over the last 6 years, if you want to have a better life, then we have to elect a better government. And that really is my job.
That's very well said. So now we have this political, this municipal election in front of us, and you know, you're the municipal politician. You're the pundit here.
Oh, so, they're not allowed to be a pundit. I can pundit a little bit.
I would like you to give us some thoughts on what you've observed as an outsider coming to Fort McMurray with this election.
Well, what's interesting to me, having just landed in Fort McMurray, is across the province, this municipal election has been a snoozer. People are not paying attention. Even in Edmonton, where we're going to have a new mayor, you know, the rate of interest in this is very low. And certainly the changes that the UCP put in for municipal financing, which they thought would elect more small-C conservative folks — we have parties now in Calgary and Edmonton — have had the opposite effect. They've turned everyone off the election, which is really very sad. And I think part of that, too, is that, you know, I was a municipal politician for a long time. I had six premiers when I was mayor of Calgary. And largely the provincial government treats municipalities with a bit of disdain or a bit of indifference. This provincial government treats them with contempt, taking away their powers to negotiate directly on things like housing with the federal government, giving the provincial government the power to disallow bylaws. I mean, it's really bad. It's really very much fighting against the right of people to elect their representatives locally. We're not that. I could never be that. I was the mayor for a long time, so I want to fix that. But what I really want to tell people is get out and vote. It really matters. Ignore all the noise. Ignore the conservative, non-conservative stuff, and just vote for the candidates who are from your community, who believe in making the community better. But I will tell you, the thing that's been the most interesting to me is, in the few hours since I landed, people are talking about the election here way more than they have in other communities. And I think that's great. And I'm not going to make any endorsements, but I will say there are people whose signs I have seen, who are people I have worked with, and I'm thrilled that people of that caliber and that quality are running for office here.
The regional municipality has given us a little bit of data recently that over 1,800 people have voted in the advance polls already, which is a record for Fort McMurray.
Oh, that's great. And it's down by a third in Calgary and Edmonton.
Yeah, and also, you know, just the raw number of candidates, we have over 30 people running for seats in, for the six seats in Ward 1. You know, and on
Did
the
you say 30
over
people?
30 people.
Wow.
And on the school front, we have, between the Catholic and public school boards, we have over 48 people running.
And let me say a word about the school board elections, because those are always the poor sisters of municipal elections and people forget about them. It is hard to be a school board trustee. You're paid very poorly. You work really hard. You represent lots of people. And we're in a situation where public education is a mess. Elect great trustees. You know, there has been a movement. The folks behind Take Back Alberta have said, oh, no one pays attention to school board elections. We're going to get our guys in there and our girls in there. Don't let them do that. You know, vote for the people who advocate for the kids. Vote for people who advocate for great public education. And do not let apathy or indifference or ignorance get in the way of electing great people. So I'm thrilled to hear so many people are running, because I had heard that just before the election, it looked like you might have acclamations. And now there's this huge groundswell of interest, which I love. And school board trustees are awesome. City and municipal councillors are really the bedrock of public service. And I love them. I have a ton of respect for them. And so if you're listening, candidates out there, you got 4 days or 5 days before the election when this airs, get back on the doors.
Let's go a little bit further into this school board topic. You know, up until Jim Dinning was Minister of Education, school boards had the right to set their own mill rate for property tax. And, you know, the superintendent served at the, you know, at the pleasure of the board. Those powers of the trustees have been largely eroded, where they're almost seem like the buffer between the provincial government and the angry parent. And as you said, they don't get paid very much to take angry phone calls, but so much of what is before them can't be handled at the, or is not allowed to be handled at the municipal level. For example, you cannot hire or change your superintendent without also getting the rubber stamp from the provincial government. Your budget is set by the provincial government. Yeah. Your negotiating power with unions is severely limited.
It's province-wide negotiation now. That's why we have a province-wide strike.
Yeah, and you know, EAs here, the CUPE, that was last year, that could be handled locally, but only with the very rigid budget that was set by the by the provincial government. Would you change any of that to empower local school boards?
Yeah, this is a really critical question. By the way, I stood on the line in the Fort McMurray winter with those education assistants as they were striking and doing what was right for the students, and I was very proud to stand with them. You know, mostly women, mostly living at or below the poverty line in an expensive city like Fort McMurray, just trying to do the right thing for kids. And this was the challenge, because even they were saying, well, it's our employers, the school board, but the province tells them what they can offer. They sit at the negotiating table. And I believe in local democracy. I believe that if people are elected by their neighbors, we should give them the authority to do their jobs. I don't believe in centralizing power or centralizing control and restricting people's freedoms the way Premier Smith and the UCP do. Jim Dinning's signature is on my high school diploma. And it was shortly after that Ralph Klein removed a lot of the power from these school boards because he saw them as a threat to centralizing power. I think we can do a better job of that. I'm not sure the school boards would want the power to levy their own taxes again, but I think we can certainly say, look, you're the experts. You were elected by your neighbors. You know the needs of your individual communities. Let's listen to you instead of fighting with you all the time.
Yeah, that's quite a logical way to do it, especially given that the growth in Alberta, you know, is it's non-linear. Different cities have different growth rates. My last question to you, Mr. Nanshi, and I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us.
This is terrific.
Oilers or Flames?
Don't ask me that. It's the beginning of the season. So at the beginning of the season, I can revert to my true self, which is, of course, raised in Calgary, wear a lot of red, little upset that the red is coming off the license plates, as all good Flames fans should be. But the good news about the life I live now, I represent a riding in Edmonton. I split my time between Edmonton, Calgary, and the rest of the province. And come pessimistically February, optimistically May, really I won't have to choose between the two teams anymore. We're not familiar with hockey in the spring in Calgary.
And if you were offered a free skybox to attend one of the events if you were premier, would you turn that gift down?
Who's paying for it? You know, the critical thing here, and that, by the way, is the core of the corrupt care scandal, right? Which is the allegation is several ministers, without disclosing it, and the premier herself, went to playoff games in the company of some of the people who are doing business with the government. Look, I don't have a problem with the Premier going to a playoff game when the Oilers are in the playoffs. It's a thing to do for the community, right? But tell us who's taking you, and for God's sakes, don't accept tickets from somebody who has million-dollar contracts they're signing with your office. That's just common sense. So let's beef up the ethics rules, let's have full disclosure of what people do, and let's not have allegations or even the whiff or scent of kickbacks or corruption in this kind of work. But for now, I am aiming for a Flames-Oilers playoff series.
All right. Well, there you have it. Well, thank you very much for your time, and thank you for joining us here at Harvard Media News. I hope you enjoy your stay in Fort McMurray.
Thank you. It's beautiful, and thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
You bet.